The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. The People's Pharmacy, castor oil cleared up issue with toenail fungus. Question. Rather than a question, I offer a note about toenail fungus treatment. I have treated my toenails with Listerine for a few years, but saw only slight improvement. A couple of months ago, I started applying castor oil to my toenails after showering. The improvement was clear within a few days. I continue to apply castor oil to my toenails once or twice a week. My toes and feet haven't looked so good in years. I hope this helps someone else. Answer. We could find no scientific research to support the use of castor oil against nail fungus. The leaves of this plant, however, have been shown to possess both antibacterial and antifungal activity, and that's cited in BMC Research Notes, December 1, 2017. Castor oil is greasy. Applying this oil to the toenails could be messy. Be careful not to slip. There are many other home remedies for nail fungus that readers may find helpful, including Listerine and white vinegar soaks, topical hydrogen peroxide, cornmeal, tea tree oil, and white iodine. To learn more about these and other nail fungus treatments, you may want to read our book, Quick and Handy Home Remedies. It is available at your local library or at peoplespharmacy.com. Question. I use almonds to stop heartburn. After years of being on Prilosec and thinking there was no way off it, I stopped. I keep almonds with me wherever I go. At home, I also drink aloe vera juice and take licorice root pills, DGL. Every once in a while, I have to take a Zantac, but not often. Answer. Scientists, writing in the World Journal of Gastroenterology, March 14, 2011, characterize almonds as a traditional heartburn remedy in Israel. We haven't seen any studies on whether eating a few almonds actually helps heartburn, but scores of readers attest that it does. An extract of licorice has been shown to ease digestion. That's cited in Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine, Volume 2012. DGL is a safer version of licorice because the glycyrrhizin that can raise blood pressure has been removed. Are sunscreens effective against skin cancer? Question. It seems to me sunscreens may prevent burning, but I'm not sure they prevent skin cancer. The incidence of all types of skin cancer has increased since sunscreens were introduced. I also worry that people who shun the sun completely may be missing out on vitamin D. Can you help? Answer. Consistent sunscreen use is a pillar of public health campaigns for preventing skin cancer, but the evidence upon which this is based is surprisingly skimpy. Cited in Cochrane Database of Systemic Reviews, July 25, 2016. Although highly effective sunscreens have long been available, skin cancer rates have been rising. A meta-analysis of 29 studies showed no significant association between skin cancer and sunscreen use. Cited in the European Journal of Dermatology, April 1, 2018, the authors write, quote, "While the current evidence suggests no increased risk of skin cancer related to sunscreen use, this systematic review does not confirm the expected protective benefits of sunscreen against skin cancer in the general population," unquote. We would have expected that the more sunscreen used, the less skin cancer. It still makes sense to protect yourself from sunburn, which is painful as well as dangerous. Sunscreen does prevent vitamin D formation in the skin, or else supplements might be helpful. Question. I had no problems with my blood sugar until I started taking rosuvastatin. It caused body aches and that's called Crestor, brand name. It caused body aches and unexplained abdominal pain. I stopped taking it and felt much better, but my doctor said, because of my borderline cholesterol, I have to take statins. After a year of taking statins, my cholesterol levels are normal, but I have diabetes. I have body aches, leg cramps, and extreme fatigue. Could the statins be responsible? Answer, statins like rosuvastatin and simvastatin, which are Crestor and Zocor, can raise blood sugar. Such drugs also may lead to stomach ache, muscle pain, and weakness. Many readers also complain of leg cramps. Our guides to cholesterol control and heart health and managing diabetes offer other options. Getting a Leg Up with Bone Density Testing by Jane Brody of the New York Times. Newly updated guidelines can help women decide when to have a bone density tested to determine their risk of fracture and perhaps get treatment that can lessen it. But the new guidelines may further discourage already reluctant men from doing the same. The guidelines issued by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force suggest that all women 65 and older undergo bone density screening, a brief, non-invasive, safe, and inexpensive test covered by Medicare. It is called a DEXA scan, D-E-X-A. For women past menopause who are younger than 65, the guidelines say a scan may be appropriate depending on their risk factors for osteoporosis. But for men, the task force said current evidence is insufficient to assess the balance of benefits and harms of screening for osteoporosis to prevent osteoporotic fractures. Not all experts in bone health agree. As I wrote in this column in October 2016, although men get about half as many osteoporotic fractures as women, when a man breaks his hip because of osteoporosis, he is more likely than a woman similarly afflicted to be permanently disabled and twice as likely to die within a year. And thanks to the decline in smoking and progress in treating heart disease, many more men are now living long enough to experience a debilitating and perhaps deadly osteoporotic fracture. As Dr. Robert A. Adler, an endocrinologist at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Richmond, Virginia, has written, it is time to stop thinking of osteoporosis as just a lady's disease. With age, virtually everyone loses bone density, a process that typically starts at age 30 and accelerates rapidly in women past menopause who do not take supplemental estrogen. In men who enter adulthood with thicker, stronger bones, bone loss in midlife is more gradual but often becomes medically significant after age 70. Osteoporosis causes bones to weaken and potentially break, which can lead to chronic pain, disability, loss of independence, and even death, the task force noted. Osteoporotic fractures are very common and extremely expensive. Nearly 44 million women and men over 50, men 50 or older, more than half the people in that age bracket, have low bone density that increases their chances of breaking a bone from a minor accident, like tripping on the sidewalk or over the cat. These so-called fragility or low trauma fractures drain an estimated $20 billion, with a B, dollars a year from the U.S. economy, up from $17 billion in 2005, with a continued rise in the rate and cost predicted as the population ages. Men account for 29% of these fractures and 25% of the cost, according to a 2007 report in the Journal of Bone Mineral Research. Insurance coverage for bone density tests, both government and private, is typically based on the advice rendered by the Preventive Services Task Force. So it is helpful to know what the group recommends, but it can also help to know when it may be wise to circumvent these guidelines. Few question the value of bone density screening for women 65 and older, with timely repetitions of the exam determined by the initial results. The test is painless and non-invasive and involves a level of radiation 50 times lower than that of a mammogram. Dr. Margaret Gourlay, Research Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina, told me, there is also solid evidence that treatment with a bone-preserving or bone-building drug is beneficial when a bone density test reveals a level of bone loss defined as osteoporosis in the spine or hip. Bone density testing also has a place for women younger than 65, Gourlay said. The question is, for which women and how often should it be done? The task force concluded that the need for an initial test is best determined By first examining a woman's risk factors, a process that Gourlay said could consume half the time of a typical doctor visit. There are three such screening tools currently available. The most popular and most time-consuming risk assessment tool is called a FRAX, F-R-A-X. It involves a list of about a dozen factors that can influence a person's risk of osteoporosis and estimates the cost of a major osteoporotic fracture occurring in the next 10 years. The factors include age, sex, weight, height, previous fracture, parental fracture history, smoking, alcohol consumption, and the use of steroids. If the FRAX assessment deems a woman's risk is 3% or higher for a hip fracture or 20% or higher for a fracture on the forearm, shoulder, or spine, she is likely to be urged to get a bone density test if she is 40 or older. A somewhat simpler assessment called SCORE, S-C-O-R-E, calculates risk based on race, rheumatoid arthritis, fracture history, age, estrogen use, and weight. Walking briskly for your health means about 100 steps a minute. And this is an article by Gretchen Reynolds from the New York Times. Most of us know that we should walk briskly for the sake of our health. But how fast is brisk? A helpful new study concludes that seems to be about 100 steps per minute. Current exercise guidelines do not always define what brisk walking means. Even the simplest, often cited description of brisk walking can be vague and confusing. Used by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other agencies in their guidelines, it defines brisk walking and other moderate intensity activities as occurring at a pace at which people can talk but not sing. That definition seemed impractical to Katrine Tudor Locke, a professor of kinesiology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, who has long studied how much exercise might be needed or sufficient for health. Who wants to sing when they walk, she asks. So, for the new study, which was published in June in a special issue of the British Journal of Sports Medicine devoted to the topic of walking, she and her colleagues decided to see whether there was enough data already available to develop a more precise and useful definition of brisk walking. They began by looking for recent, good quality published studies that had tracked people's walking pace and cadence, which is the number of steps they take per minute, as well as other measures of their effort, such as heart rate or increases in respiration. They wanted to see if there were consistencies between an easy-to-use number, such as steps per minute, and more technical determinations of intensity, such as respiration. They also wanted to find studies that had examined people of varying ages and body mass indexes to see if a single measure of what makes walking brisk could apply to almost everyone. But despite the differences, the data about what made walking brisk was consistent across all the studies Tudor Locke and her colleagues found. Brisk walking involved a pace of about 2.7 miles per hour, or about 100 steps per minute. The good news is that this pace will probably not feel strenuous to most healthy people, she says. Unless you are past about age 60, she adds, some older people needed to take quite a few more than 100 steps per minute to walk briskly, she says, while others achieve briskness with lower step cadences. The current federal exercise guidelines suggest 30 minutes of brisk walking most days. From the Harvard Health Letter, the benefits and risks of multi-generational fitness parks. Playful exercise is not just about fun and games. One new exercise trend can make you feel like a kid again. Multi-generational fitness parks are cropping up across the United States. These parks typically include a large child-focused structure with places to climb, slide, swing, hang, and jump. They may also be walking paths and places for interaction between older and younger people, such as seating and picnic tables painted with tabletop games like checkers. Sounds like a regular park, right? What's different is that the playground equipment is often adult-friendly. Swings are sturdy and roomy. Slides are wide with gentle slopes. And seesaws have ergonomically designed seats that are easy to sit on. The equipment makes it possible for adults to play alongside their kids or grandkids or other children. A recent surge. Multi-generational fitness parks have been gaining popularity around the world for the past decade. In the United States, the trend is being driven by local government parks and recreation departments, as well as organizations such as the Trust for Public Land, which is www.ttpl.org, and nonprofit playground builder Kaboom, which is www.kaboom.org, which has teamed up with large health-related companies to create almost 60 multi-generational parks across the country. A lot of older people are often caregivers for children. They're spending time at playgrounds, and they need an opportunity to be active alongside the kids they're with, says Lindsay Adeyiga, Kaboom Director of Corporate Partnerships. Not just kid stuff. Near the playground, you'll often find large, colorful fitness equipment designed for late teens and adults. That includes ergonomically shaped bars to hold on for squats or modified wall push-ups, leg presses, and recumbent bicycles to build leg, hip, and core muscles, an overhead press to build shoulder and arm strength, and even elliptical or cross-country ski machines for a total body workout. When used properly, the equipment can help you improve balance, strength, flexibility, range of motion, and coordination. To assist you with that, signs with instructions and illustrations are often posted near each exercise station. Benefits. Multi-generational fitness parks are free, and you can visit them on your own schedule. And there's more. The exercise machines resemble playground equipment. If you dislike exercising, you may feel like you're just playing or not working. You can exercise with your friends, kids, or grandkids. Being with others helps stave off loneliness and depression, which are associated with chronic disease. Exercising with other people is a motivator. You get a healthy sense of competition if you see other people doing a workout, says Madhuri Kale, a physical therapist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. And finally, there's no one judging you or telling you which machines or exercises you should try or how long to exercise. You can play just like a kid. Playground risks. But some of those benefits can wind up being risks. If you're exercising without expert supervision, you may do so incorrectly and hurt yourself. My concern is that it's so inviting, someone might be tempted to jump on the equipment and play without warming up and injure a muscle, says Kale. If you're caught up in the spirit of playtime or competition, you may overdo it and risk muscle injury. In addition, it may be tricky to get on and off playground equipment, which can increase your risk for fall. What should you do? Stay away from playground equipment or outdoor exercise machines if you have balance problems and can fall, or if you've had surgery anywhere along your torso in the last 12 weeks, because you could rupture an incision, warns Kale. She recommends that you get your doctor's okay first. Once you're at a park, start by warming up. Even just a short, brisk walk will help get the blood pumping and muscles primed, Kale says. Then be mindful of the workout you're getting, and don't do more than you would at a gym. So pack a few water bottles, wear sunscreen, and enjoy the unbridled joy of outdoor playtime, the original workout for all of us. Common summer skin rashes. What to do about prickly heat, poison ivy, and other uncomfortable skin reactions. Sunburn is a big risk in the summer. You know the rules. Seek shade, wear protective clothing, and use a broad-spectrum sunscreen with an SPF of at least 30. But sunburn isn't the only summer skin problem. Plant-related rashes. Many people are allergic to urushiol, an oil found in poison ivy and poison oak. Exposure occurs when you touch the plant directly, maybe while gardening, or indirectly by touching an object that's picked up the oil, like a shoe. You can spread the oil wherever you touch your body until the oil is washed off. 2 to 10 days later, the affected skin develops a red, itchy, blistering, oozing rash it's not contagious, but you may feel like it's spreading. The allergic reaction continues to unfold even after you've washed off all the oil, says Dr. Jason Frangos, a dermatologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. The best treatment, a prescription-strength topical steroid and an oral steroid for extreme cases. An over-the-counter hydrocortisone treatment is too weak to help, Dr. Frangos notes. The rash may last for several weeks. Prickly heat. When you perspire a lot, your clothing or even the material of a chair you're sitting on can block some of the openings in your skin that allow sweat to escape. This causes the ducts that carry sweat to the skin to become inflamed, creating a rash of small itchy bumps wherever the material touches you. It's called prickly heat because you feel a prickly sensation as the bumps burst and sweat is released. But don't worry, the best remedy is to let your skin breathe. Wear loose clothing and make sure your skin is dry and cool, says Dr. Frangos. For immediate relief, try cool compresses or an over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream. Sun allergy. Sometimes the immune system mistakenly attacks as foreign components of skin that have been damaged by sun exposure. Often during the first sunny days of the season, some people break out in an itchy rash on the skin that's been exposed to the sun, like the face, ears, and neck. That reaction may lessen as summer wears on, though some people may need to stay carefully sun protected all summer long, Dr. Frangos says. Side effects from your medication. Certain medications can make some people sensitive to the sun's radiation, resulting in immediate sunburn. Prime suspects, certain antibiotics, thiazide diuretics, contraceptive pills, antihistamines, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen or Advil. They lower your threshold to burn. It's best to seek the shade, wear sunscreen, and work with your doctor to see if an alternative treatment is available. When should you see a doctor? Contact your doctor if one of these rashes persists and prevents you from sleeping, working, or relaxing. But it's different for poison ivy. In most cases, says Dr. Frangos, it's worth contacting your doctor just to get a prescription-strength medication that will improve your symptoms. The health benefits of shared living. Americans want, or living with others, offers a way to stay independent and avoid a cascade of mental, emotional, and physical health problems. Americans want to age in place. AARP finds that 9 out of 10 people ages 65 or older want to stay in their homes in their later years. That goal isn't always achievable because of challenges of independence, such as a limited income or chronic health problems. Sometimes it's frailty, weakness, stiffness, and aching joints creep up on you, decrease function, and keep you from climbing stairs or taking care of yourself or your home, says Dr. Aaron Stevens, a geriatrician and palliative care physician at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. But several trends indicate that older adults are finding ways to stay in a home setting, and each of these trends involves shared living. Living with family. Increasingly, older adults appear to be moving in with their family members. An analysis of data collected by the U.S. Census Bureau conducted for the Harvard Health Letter by Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, which is JCHS, found that between 2001 and 2016, the number of Americans ages 65 or older increased by 40%. During the same period, the number of people 65 or older living in a grown child's home nearly doubled from 1.4 to 3.4 million, as did the number living in a sibling's home from 226,000 to 453,000. What is causing these trends? For one thing, people are living longer. For another, fewer are dying suddenly from heart attacks and strokes. In addition, demographic changes in the U.S. population may be contributing to the shift. As our population becomes more culturally diverse, we'll see more multi-generational households. For example, traditionally Asian and Hispanic households are more likely to include three generations. says Jennifer Malinsky, senior researcher with the JCHS. Getting housemates. For some older adults, the way to stay in a home setting is to share a home with people who aren't family members. The JCHS analysis found that the number of older adults living with non-relatives went from about 400,000 in 2001 to about 900,000 in 2016. This may mean that you buy or rent a home with another adult who isn't your family member, or that you take in boarders. Your tenants could be your friends or other adults you meet by placing an ad for renters. Malinsky says that one of the drivers of this trend is income. We see that 60% of people in their 80s who have a mortgage or who rent a home are cost burdened, paying so much for housing that they have to make trade-offs and cut back on other things like food or medicine, she explains. Sharing a home helps offset housing costs, but the perks go beyond finances. Avoiding isolation. Many older adults are at risk for isolation and loneliness, partly because of their relationship status. Maybe they're divorced or they've lost a partner, but also because of their living arrangements. We see that 3/4 of older adults are aging in suburbs or rural areas, which has the potential to be isolating, especially when you give up driving with age. Isolation and loneliness are risk factors for many health problems. When you live alone, you're at a higher risk for memory decline, depression, heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, and stress. But having someone in the home is socially and mentally stimulating, and it may prevent other problems. Other benefits. Living with others can help you stay independent in other ways, too, depending on the situation. For example, it could lead you to cook and eat healthier food. If you live by yourself, you might not have the money, ability, or motivation to prepare food. Living with someone else can change that. You might have someone to assist you with personal care. An adult, child, or friend may be able to help you dress, assist with your medicine, or encourage you to exercise and socialize. It can reduce your workload. You may gain a means of transportation, and you have someone there for you in case of an emergency like a stroke. Making it work. It's important to set boundaries with living in others, with others, and remember the risks of boundary issues may be far outweighed by the benefits of living with them. It's about being noticed and visible and having function and purpose. It's waking up in the morning and seeing other people. It gives you independence, but it also gives you the rhythm of life and keeps you in it. How do you find a housemate? Well, there are several websites, such as the New York Foundation for Senior Citizens, Let's Share Housing, Nesterly in Boston. Make sure your housemate is fully vetted in advance and signs a contract spelling out the rent, house rules, and options to cancel the agreement. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And stay healthy.